Last week we read the story of the death of Lazarus and how Jesus raised him from the dead. It was the seventh and final sign in the book of John. We've seen lots of signs in the book of John, and this was the seventh and the final sign. And I use the word sign. Sometimes people in the past have used the word miracle, but I use the word sign. Well, John uses the word sign, but we use the word sign also because the word sign is something that points beyond itself. It's revealing something unseen. It's pointing to a greater reality. And that's what the death and the raising of Lazarus did, right? It wasn't about Jesus just demonstrating that he's got some godly resurrection powers that he can use at will. But it wasn't pointing to just the fact that one day we'll all be resurrected. Because even Martha herself says, right? She says, yes, I know he'll rise again in the resurrection at the last day. So this sign was pointing to not just the resurrection, but it was pointing to Jesus as being our resurrection. It was pointing to Jesus as our resurrection and life. And it was not only just pointing to the resurrection and life, but he was pointing that this is beginning to break in now. It's a present reality. Now, I start there just to remind us of last week because this is critical for us to understand, this climax, this overwhelming sign of the future resurrection and hope that we have in Jesus. I remind us because we need to understand how the Pharisees are feeling at this point. So in our passage that we're going to read today, we're going to start at chapter 11, starting at verse 45 is where we left off last week, and we're going to go all the way to chapter 12, verse 8. So let me read that with you. Therefore, many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary had seen what Jesus did, put their faith in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin. What are we accomplishing? They asked. Here is this man performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him. And then the Romans will come and take away both our temple and our nation. And then one of them named Caiaphas, who was a high priest that year, spoke up. You know nothing at all. You do not realize that it is better for you that one man die for the people than that the whole nation perish. And John knows he did not say this on his own, but as a high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the Jewish nation. And not only that, for the nation, but also for the scattered children of God, to bring them together and make them one. So from that day on, they plotted to take his life. Therefore, Jesus no longer moved about publicly among the Jews. Instead, he withdrew to a region near the wilderness, to a village called Ephraim, where he stayed with his disciples. And when it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, many went up from the country to Jerusalem for their ceremonial cleansing before the Passover. They kept looking for Jesus, and as they stood in the temple courts, they asked one another, "What do you think? Is he coming to the festival at all?" But the chief priests and the Pharisees had given orders to anyone who had found out where Jesus was should report it so that they might arrest him. 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany, where Lazarus lived, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. Here a dinner was given in Jesus' honor. Martha served, while Lazarus was among those reclining at the table with him. Then Mary took a pint of pure nard, an expensive perfume, and she poured it on Jesus' feet and wiped his feet with her hair. And the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. But one of the disciples, Judas Iscariot, who was later to betray him, objected. Why wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor? It was worth a year's wages. But he did not say this because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. As keeper of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put into it. Leave her alone, Jesus replied. It was intended that she should save this perfume for the day of my burial. You will always have the poor among you, but you will not always have me. This is a reading of our Lord. Would you pray with me? Our Heavenly Father, we just ask that you would give us a word afresh today. We ask that you would give us faith to receive that word, that you would give us understanding to know what it means, and that you would give us the will to put it into practice. Amen. So we are presented with two particular scenes in today's readings. First, the plot to kill Jesus, and then secondly, Jesus being anointed at Bethany. It's kind of two dissimilar scenes in some ways. I'd like to retitle them. I want to title the first one, Right Question, Wrong Answer. And I want to title the second one, The Model and Her Perfume. And you'll understand why later. So these are two dissimilar stories, but I think there's actually a really significant connection between the two of them. And if you stay awake in the next 18 minutes, we'll get to that. So the right question, the wrong response. So we read that the raising of Lazarus has two results. First, that many Jews put their faith in Jesus. The right response. In seeing the raising of Lazarus, people put their faith in Jesus. They began to trust him, began to follow him. But we also read that some went away to the Pharisees and told them about it. Now, the text is silent on what their motives are in sharing that to them, so we'll hold back judgment there. But it's very clear what the Pharisees' response is. I think the Pharisees, they respond with fear. They don't respond with amazement or awe or hope, but they respond with fear. In a way, they do ask the right question, but I think they end with the wrong response. They ask the question, what are we accomplishing? Probably a good question. Maybe it's time for them to step back and ask, what are they accomplishing? You know, Jesus has performed sign after sign in the book of in John's gospel, right? He's turned water into wine. He's done healings. He's done the feeding of the 5,000. He's walked on water. And now he has literally raised a man from the dead. It's probably time for them to step back and say, what are we accomplishing? Maybe they have it wrong. Maybe they don't understand. But I think they ask this question with a different implication. I think they're saying sort of like, what are we accomplishing? It's comparative, right? What are we accomplishing? And don't we have that tendency? Sometimes, hey, that's our fallen tendency to kind of look at ourselves and say, you know, what are we accomplishing? When in the midst of seeing someone's good fortune, in the midst of seeing, maybe someone having success in their business or their vocation, or maybe even as a church, maybe we see another church growing or having significant, you know, spiritual growth. We tend to ask the question, you know, what are we accomplishing? And it tells us so much of what's in their hearts, right? And I sat on this question. I couldn't get past it for a while. What are we accomplishing? One thing I've learned as a pastor to university students is that I've learned that it's not about me trying to get better and better answers for my students, but it's about helping them come up with better and better questions, helping them ask better and better questions. And I think that should be our posture. When we gathered together on Monday for our AGM, I sat there wondering, what are the questions the elders are asking? as a member, I was wondering, as the people coming in, I was like, what are the questions on people's hearts as a member of First Baptist? We as a community, right? We're a community of disciples on mission together. What are the questions at our hearts? As I meet with students on the campus, I try to burn two questions in their minds. Over and over again, I ask these questions of the students that I'm mentoring and discipling, and I always come back to them. How are you obeying Jesus in your life right now? And how are you looking more and more like Jesus? How are you obeying him? How are you looking more and more like him? I think as a church, for sure, it's good for us to step back, you know, annual general meetings and those kind of things. It's good for us to step back and say, what are we accomplishing? What are we producing? Where are we going? What does this look like? But I think on our hearts should always be that first question as a community, saying, how are we obeying Jesus? How is this community looking more and more like Jesus? Are we being faithful to the calling that Jesus has called us to? The Pharisees begin with the right question, but I think they have the wrong response. They say, if we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him. That's right. But their follow-through, right? This final sign leads them to believe that they've reached a point of political crisis. And Caiaphas, the chief priest, he steps forward and he confronts their anxieties and he confronts them with this brutal political realism. He says his death would be a small price to pay for the survival of our temple and our nation. Jesus is judged and condemned in his absence. And as a result, Jesus is no longer able to move about publicly, we read. Which I think is really interesting, because when Jesus is not able to move about publicly, pay attention to what he does. What does he do with that private time? What does he do I'm always interested in knowing what leaders do in their private time. We see people publicly, but what do they do in their private time? Here we read that when Jesus is no longer able to move about publicly, he retreats to spend time with his disciples. We've seen this over and over in the Gospels, right? This pattern of Jesus spending time with the disciples, this rhythm of public ministry and retreating away, of public teaching and then private instruction to his disciples, of time with the masses and then one-on-one time with his disciples. And I think that's a really good rhythm for us to follow. Up at UCM on the campus, we only get our student leaders for maybe 2, maybe 3 years at best. And so by necessity, we always have to be embedding in them that mentality of replacing themselves. And so consistently, we're encouraging our student leaders to spend time with 1 or 2 or maybe even 3 other students, mentoring and discipling them. For every role that they're involved in, we ask them to be spending time apart with mentoring and discipling someone else. And I wonder if First Baptist Church, if that might be something we would adopt. For every public ministry that you're involved in, whether it's Sunday school or whether it's helping with floor hockey or whether it's cooking soup for Sundays, even those who help us with ushering, are we pulling away with our public ministry time and having time where we are intentionally mentoring and discipling someone else? Are we building into our lives a rhythm of doing and being? Let's get back to the narrative. It's almost Passover. Many Jews are beginning to expect the journey up to Jerusalem, and there's a buzz among the people. Will Jesus show up? Will he show up? They wonder. And it kind of makes me think of like those superhero movies, you know, like Batman or whatever, when the hero's not there and people are like, is he going to show up? Will our hero appear? Will our rescuer show up? And the days are counting down to Passover, and Jesus decides to spend his time with his closest friends. And a dinner is given in his honor, at which Martha serves. Did you catch that when we read that? Two little words, right? Martha served. And if you know the scriptures, if you know the other gospels, there's that story, right, about Mary and Martha, about how the first time when Jesus visited the home of Martha, how Martha was distracted, right, with all the preparations. And her sister Mary, it was contrasted to her sister Mary, who chose what is better, that she sat at Jesus' feet and listened and learned. So these two words, this is John's little nod. He's given us a little nod to remember that story. But he takes us further, right? Here we have a second story about Mary, which is pretty remarkable. We have two stories about this disciple, Mary, who makes the better choice. And this time, though, Mary not just only sits at Jesus' feet, but she takes a pint of expensive perfume. The text says that it's worth a year's wages. Now, I don't know how much you make a year, but that's a lot of money. And so, you know, you wonder, is Mary's household well off? Is this some kind of family heirloom that's been, you know, stewarded in her family? We don't know. The text doesn't say. But what we know is that Jesus finds this as a loving expression of devotion. He approves of it. He accepts it, right? He doesn't stop her and say, no, that you shouldn't do that. He finds it a loving expression of devotion. And the text even says that the fragrance of the perfume fills the house. Where before they were worried, remember last week, they were worried about the stench of the body when they'd open it up. And then here in today's passage, the house fills with this fragrance. It's like the gospel is meant to fill our world. The fragrance fills the house. So more than just making a better choice, Mary teaches us here what extravagant devotion to Jesus is. There's no gift too precious to show our gratitude to what Jesus is about to do. Jesus is worthy of our extravagant devotion. And the text even says that when Mary pours the perfume over his feet, that she also wiped his feet with her hair. A little detail, but women in that culture, they didn't let their hair down. In that time, in that culture, they didn't let their hair down. The only time a woman would let her hair down was in the private presence of her husband. So this is an intimate situation here. This is Mary acting with like reckless abandonment. She's not thinking about social norms in that way. She is just having this expression of reckless abandonment and devotion to Jesus. She has this great affection for Jesus. It's a spontaneous act that comes out of the fullness of her heart. And it made me pause. I don't know if it makes you pause, but it made me pause and think, man, what are the signs in my life of reckless devotion? What acts in my life do I do that bubble out of the fullness of my heart? In what ways do we, as a church, you know, what ways are we going to put on signs and display signs of extravagant devotion to Jesus? Will there be signs of that? Will our neighbors pick up on that? Will this community pick up on that? Now, I don't know about you, but maybe you're sitting here wondering, gosh, all this talk of intimacy and devotion, and I'm not very comfortable with that. What does that look like for me to be devoted intimately to Jesus? Well, this act of devotion also made Judas really uncomfortable too. Right? He gets up and he stands and he objects to the waste of this expensive perfume. He says it could have been sold and given to the poor. Now, John makes us very aware that that Judas wasn't sincere in this argument. It's not a real sincere question. He's not actually asking about that. And his heart later is revealed. He was a thief. Ultimately, he is the one who betrays Jesus. But Jesus does give him a response. First, he defends Mary, right? Which is huge. Over and over, actually, in the scriptures, we see Jesus defending women, protecting women, uplifting women. It's very radical in this day. I've been using the language of a disciple. I think Mary is a disciple. She's one who is learning and following, and I think she's actually a model of perfect devotion. We don't see anything wrong that she does. She over and over gets it right. She chooses right. She chooses great devotion to Jesus. It's the 12 that we kind of get in the scriptures where we kind of wrestle with their learning and Jesus and the gospel writers are trying to teach us about how they're learning as disciples. But here Mary is this, you know, the two scenes we get with her are an amazing model of discipleship. So first Jesus defends her and says, leave her alone. And then he explains, you'll always have the poor among you, but you will not always have me. Now, I don't think Jesus is being morally lax here. He isn't double backing on all the previous teachings about the importance of the poor. I think essentially Jesus is kind of saying, you're asking the wrong question. It's not a question of either or. It's not a question of do we do social responsibility or do we do worship and devotion to Jesus. He's saying, it's not an either or, you're missing the point. And to me, that's a little scary. Like, he's saying to Judas, one of the 12, the guy who spent present time, 3 years, saw everything Jesus did, walked with him, spent time with him, and he completely misses it. It's basically what he's saying. He's saying you're missing it. Judas knew the cost of everything, but the value of nothing. And so I think what we're learning in this passage here is that Jesus changes everything. When one enters the kingdom, when one is encountered with Jesus in their life, their world becomes entirely turned upside down. And this isn't just in Mary's life. Of course, like, we get this in Mary's life. Her life is just turned upside down. But we also, we're getting it through the gospel writer John. If we look, if we backtrack a bit and we look at how John refers to Caiaphas, I think it's really interesting. John refers to him as the high priest of that year. He says it twice, actually. In verse 49, he says, one of them named Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year. And then later in verse 51, he says, he did not say this on his own, but as the high priest of that year. Now, when I was doing my research, I kind of thought, oh, okay, so our high priests, do they change every year? Is there a different one each year? How does that work? I mean, that's sort of what it seems to imply, right? But no. Caiaphas had been the high priest for his whole life. Like, high priests, when they step into that position, they're high priests for their whole lives. And Caiaphas had already been the high priest for 20 years at this point. So it's like, why is John referring to him as the high priest of that year? Strange. Well, this is why I think he does it. John has had his life radically transformed by Jesus. This event that we're about to get to, that Jesus dies on a cross and then is raised to life, has radically reoriented his life to the point which everything in his life is measured around that event. So for John, it's not a question of who is the high priest that year, the year that Jesus died and was resurrected. Who happened to be the high priest that year? I think Caiaphas or something, some insignificant person. That's what he's doing here. He's telling us that what we need to focus on, the thing that radically reorients our life, is Jesus. And surprisingly, though, we see that God does use the words of Caiaphas to point prophetically to what would ultimately be true, that Jesus would die for the nations. So Caiaphas ends up saying something is more true than he knows. And the same is true with Mary, right? Mary's act of devotion here ends up being a prophetic sign that points to Jesus' coming, death, and burial. Like, does she know that he's going to die and be buried soon after this? No, she doesn't know that. It's something that's more than she knows. So both Mary and Caiaphas end up saying something more than they know. And I think that's just amazing. That's the connection between the two passages here. That God is moving and acting in our world, in our lives, in our mission together in ways that are more important than we possibly could know. The things are not only as they seem in our world. God is orchestrating something much greater than we know at all times. It made me think about one of our student alumni. Her name is Diane. And Diane just started working at our campus in Vancouver just this year in September. And Diane was a student of mine when I was pastoring in Vancouver. And she is a short, just constantly smiling, joy-filled, just exudes joy. She's a little Filipino spark plug, she is. And I thought about, this made me think about when she wanted to go on our Mexico house building trip. And she didn't have the funds. And the night that we asked for commitments to the trip, she expressed to me that she really wanted to go on this trip, but she didn't have the money. And I encouraged her. I said, well, if you really feel called to go on this trip, then I would just place your trust in God, and he'll provide a way. And she did. And that night she said, you know, she prayed about it and she thought about it. And she came to me and she said, you know, James, I'm just going to step out and I'm going to say, okay, I'm in. And she was a little trepidatious, but she committed to trusting that God would provide for her. And I kid you not, by the end of that night, I had a student come to me and say, I planned on going on this trip, but I'm unable to go. Here's $1,000. I want someone else to go. $1,000 from a student. It's not quite a year's wages, but it's quite a bit. I remember feeling just amazed to see how God just orchestrated that. That he just made that way for her. It built her faith huge. That was an extravagant act of generosity that came out of a place of devotion from this student. But you know what? When I caught up with Diane this year at one of our staff meetings, and I started asking her, well, how'd you end up like coming back? She'd been out, graduated for a few years, working at a nonprofit in the city. And she began to tell me her story about how she just felt God calling her to go give back to campus ministry, to give herself full time to working in Vancouver on the campus there. And I was just blown away to see how God continues to build her faith in her life in that way. And I thought back to this moment of when this student did this generous act of generosity. They knew that they were enabling someone to go on a trip, but they had no idea how God would use that in her life to build her faith, to put her on a path of trusting Jesus with her whole life. First Baptist Church, God is orchestrating something much greater than we can imagine or hope for in our lives. We follow a God who is worthy of our extravagant devotion. We follow a God who is able to do far greater than we can ever know. Jesus changes everything in our lives, and he is worthy of giving everything of ourselves to him.